Welcome, ladies and gents. It's Lana, the looks-obsessed eugenicist and fascist pinup podcaster here. Well, at least according to some guys, no one cares about it at the New York Magazine. But hey, it's not an insult, it's a compliment in my view. Joining me tonight is Philosophy Cat, a nationalist YouTuber who loves politics, philosophy, and cats. But no, she is not a crazy cat lady. We'll explore how to talk to normies, what the left gets right, which isn't much, and canceling your Netflix. For the love of the gods, cancel your Netflix, people. But we also spend a good amount of time on misconceptions about women like us and their relationships with men, and the most likely leftist agitators who harass women like us saying all the cliche things in comment sections. Why do they do this, and why have they specifically been targeting my show? They're desperate to scare away girls and make alt-right men look like bitter, stupid idiots. Because the fact is, any man who attacks a young woman who openly shows her face while defending white people is not one of us. But she also brings up white Sharia, which couldn't possibly be real, could it? Sadly, we had a technical issue during this portion of the conversation and a small bit was cut off, but you'll get the picture. Philosophicat is next. Philosophicat, welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me. I really like your show.
So tell us about the white cat that shows up in your videos.
My white cat is, he's a very Aryan looking cat, but that was not actually intentional. He's a rescue cat. We took him in initially as a foster. I had no idea what kind of cat they were going to bring me. And I never actually wanted a white cat. I always thought I was going to get a gray cat or a black cat. And they brought me a little white cat, and we weren't intending to keep him forever, but within about 2 weeks, we decided that we needed to have him in our family. And he's just kind of been my constant companion. He's very much like me personality-wise, very pesty, very cheeky. And despite being 4 years old, he still doesn't take naps. That's why sometimes in my videos, he's kind of running around doing crazy cat stuff and won't leave me alone.
It's funny. They know when you're recording or when there's cameras. I notice our cats, they like to be around that kind of energy for some reason. It's funny.
Yeah, he really likes to come and rub against the microphone, or sometimes if the computer's running warm, he wants to just lie down on top of it. So he's ruined a few video takes.
We have to be clear, too. There's a difference. You're not a cat lady. You know, there's a difference between the cat lady and people who have a cat, right?
This is true, yes.
We're big cat lovers here, too. But we're also not single women, so single women with 10 of them, right?
Yeah, well, look, I've only got one cat, so I think you need to have at least three before you're qualified as a, you know, a certifiable cat lady. But cats have a lot of qualities that women admire, you know? I mean, they're self-reliant, they're very cautious, they have concealed weapons, and they're clean, and they're territorial, they're fussy about what they want, you know, that they're just like us, really.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to alt-right topics.
I was always kind of right-wing. My family is kind of lifelong Republicans, so I sort of grew up in that kind of a household, but they're more the, like the globalist neocon type of Republicans. So it wasn't until I was probably 17 or 18 when I sort of kind of came to more like libertarian ways of thinking. And when I was about 19 is when I started coming more into nationalist ways of thinking, which is, you know, I think a lot of people think that libertarianism and nationalism aren't really compatible. But it's, for me, it wasn't too much of a leap. And it was really when I went to university, that was kind of my first real exposure to living in a multicultural city, being around a lot of other people of different backgrounds, and also just being exposed to the constant leftist propaganda in the classroom. And I can't remember exactly what triggered me to start kind of looking into that stuff, but it was a pretty rapid transformation once I did, and I've just kind of been fully red-pilled ever since.
So it's been a while for you then.
Yeah, you know, 12, 13 years.
That's pretty good. Yeah, a lot of people, it seems like it's happened rapidly in the last few years. And it obviously it's connected with all this push towards diversity and multiculturalism in our face all the time. As people say, you get red-pilled by life once you're actually living in it and around it all the time. And you came from a very white area, right? Minnesota?
I did. I grew up in an all-white town. I went to school at a pretty much all-white school. I think occasionally we had like an exchange student that was from another country. But it was a very sheltered life. And I kind of just thought like, well, Black people are just like what they are on the Cosby Show. I had no conception of like the thug life. And so going to a big city for university, and I stupidly thought that I would take the city bus into town for school. I was the only white girl on the bus. And that kind of woke me up pretty quickly to the fact that not all Blacks are like on the Cosby Show, because the ones that rode the bus were more the thug life type. Ugh. And not very nice to me.
Yep, that's how it goes. Well, for you, what are the most important issues of our time?
Well, first and foremost, obviously, the continuation of our race. I don't see any point in addressing any other issue until that one's taken care of. So when people talk about stuff like, say, oh, climate change, regardless of whether or not you believe in that, it's like, well, you know, Europeans are the only ones who actually care about taking care of the environment. Yeah. So if we get rid of Europeans, you're not going to fix climate change. So firstly, we need to ensure our continued survival at any means necessary, really. But following that, I would say just the erosion of Western values, European values. So freedom of speech, the rise of political correctness, I think is probably top of my list in terms of those eroding values. Because political correctness is essentially forcing people to lie. And if you're lying all the time and you're constantly repressing the truth, that's just going to lead to depression. It leads to our people being very demoralized. It leads to nihilism. And then who wants to even continue fighting for their people? So that does sort of go hand in hand with being able to continue our race, because we have so many people who just aren't interested in doing that.
Yeah, it's amazing that some people, they just have no impulse for that whatsoever. You could be like, well, white people might disappear. And you're talking to a white person, and so I don't care. They don't feel anything about it. There's a lot of people that don't feel anything about it. Why do you think that is?
You know, we have just been so cut off from our culture and our heritage. And I think it's worse for white people living outside of Europe, because I think in Europe, they still have more organic cultural ties. They're still in their homeland of their ancestors. And the European diaspora is less connected to that. But we're told all the time, we have no culture.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, everybody has a culture. Most people who say we don't have a culture don't even know what they're talking about. Like, ask them what culture is and they can't define it. It's not just the food you eat or the clothes you wear. It's not even just like your religious beliefs or something. It goes much deeper than that. It's, you know, your fundamental beliefs about the way the world works, the way you interact with people, and what you value as being the most important thing in life.
And people who say that white people don't have a culture clearly have not traveled around Europe. There's many different cultures there. We already have a multicultural area. It's called Europe.
Yeah. And if you are a white person saying that white people don't have culture, you have not engaged in much self-reflection about what your beliefs are and where your beliefs come from, because you didn't just come up with these ideas on your own. Someone else put them there and you believe them for whatever reason. But, you know, the idea that that women should be respected, that is a uniquely European idea. That's part of our culture. It's not this just like cultureless idea that was floating around in the ether and landed in somebody's head. Like, that's part of our tradition, is treating women as human beings, treating them with respect. Same with the idea of treating animals with respect, or treating children kindly. You know, these are fundamental beliefs in our culture that not every culture in the world shares. So to say that white people don't have a culture is, I mean, either they're intentionally dishonest and some kind of cultural Marxist, or they're incredibly stupid.
Yeah, a lot of them are stupid. They say, oh, white people don't have a culture and they didn't make anything, while they're surrounded by everything that white people have made in the country that they built. there really are a lot of stupid people, unfortunately.
Yeah, and if you point out to them that white people built this, they say that, oh, we just stole it from non-whites. And it just shows a really fundamental lack of understanding of history.
I know, sometimes we tend to get a lot of, you know, advanced, you and I, we've been thinking about these things for a while, and sometimes we have to remember where the average mind is at and really dumb it down to some of these basic double standards. I think the alt-right needs to be hammering those more often, because in our minds, we already know this stuff, but then when you're out there in the real world and you deal with some of these people, you realize how far behind they are and how they need like the really basic double standards for it to click in their head, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, this is kind of part of how it goes when you're talking with normies. You have to speak their language. If I want to convince you that speaking English is the best language in the world, but you only speak French, I'm not going to convince you by just speaking English to you. I first need to learn French, and I need to come and communicate my ideas to you in French. You know, you might feel kind of intellectually smug and superior that you've made this great argument that nobody else can understand, but what have you gained from it?
Yep, exactly. Yeah, you did a whole video about how to debate with and talk to normies, correct?
I did. It was a modified version of a presentation that I did for a workshop that I ran locally, just to kind of help people who like to spend a lot of time arguing on the internet or with their friends and family, just help them learn to debate a little bit more effectively. So we've run a couple of workshops like that. It's not just me. I've got people helping me. Couldn't do it without them. But I decided that one was the most popular one that we did. I'll put it up in a video. And I pretty much doubled it in length by adding some content to it. And the whole point of that workshop was learning to debate people without resorting to a lot of reason and evidence, because most people can't understand reason and evidence. Like maybe 10% of people are going to find that appealing. Most people need like appeals to emotion or to authority or tradition. And so what we did in that workshop was I had printed off a whole bunch of left-wing memes from the internet. And I have to say, like, we are totally winning the meme war, because I had such a hard time finding left-wing memes that made any sense or were even worth working with, because they were so stupid.
Yeah.
But I found some. I managed to get about 20 of varying quality. And so we split people up into small groups and gave them a selection of memes to choose. And they were meant to come up with a quick argument that was not based in logic and evidence against these memes. And they found it really difficult to do. They kept wanting to resort to using a lot of facts and figures and deconstructing the argument. And it's like, no, you can't talk to people like that, because the reason these leftist ideas are so effective on normies is that they appeal to emotion, not to logic.
Of course. Yeah.
So you have to fight fire with fire. And, we then kind of put people up. We'd have a designated devil's advocate, and we'd just have them debate head to head improv style, which was absolutely hilarious. And everyone had a lot of fun. But I think it kind of drove home the point that it's actually really hard to talk to people in this language of emotional appeals. And it's something that requires a lot of practice and a lot of thought if that's not your main mode of thinking.
Yeah. So what are some tips? Basically, you're talking to a family member. They're not going to respond to facts and figures. We need to be emotional. We need to explain what's happening with white displacement. How does someone go about that to actually get an emotional reaction, to open them up, to actually hear the message for a moment?
Okay. So we probably all have somebody in our lives who is, you know, the bleeding heart female liberal who thinks that we need to let all the refugee children in because she feels sad about their suffering. Think of the children. It's always think of the children.
Yeah.
Well, you can take that same line, think of the children, and say, think of white children. Think of your children. Think of the children in this country. What about their future? And you can spell it out for them. You know, this is what I think their future is going to look like if they're a minority in their own country. I mean, can we trust other races to be as generous and kind to us as we've been to them?
No, of course not.
I mean, we can be tolerant of all the Muslims in our country and say, oh, it's their freedom to practice religion. But as soon as they have the majority, I mean, they're already forming like pro-Muslim parties in some countries and getting votes. As soon as they're the majority, are they going to extend that same tolerance to us? Of course not. That's not their culture. And that, I mean, that goes back to the danger of saying that white people don't have a culture is that you then, if you believe that, you find it really hard to distinguish when someone else's culture is at odds with yours because you think, oh, I don't have any culture, but culture's good and we should have culture. Why don't I just go to the culture store and buy some? Oh, look, there's Muslim culture. Let's try that one on.
Yeah, and we should also always bring up South Africa, too. How were the white people treated in South Africa? And when they came down there, there was nothing. They built everything from nothing, and now they're literally being murdered when the blacks are running things in South Africa. So those kids, no one cares about those kids. The UN's not going there trying to save them from their government that's actively trying to kill them.
Exactly. Last year, I had a young South African fellow staying with one of the families I work with, and he really did not want to go back to South Africa. It was his first time out of the country. And he was one of the Boers and not particularly bright. He was more of an athletic type. For somebody like him, there is no future in South Africa. There is nothing for him to go back to. He's not going to get into university. He's not going to get any kind of a good job. Like, his only hope was basically to try to make it in another country. And nobody wants the South Africans.
No, they don't take
them.
They don't get refugee status.
It's really hard for them to emigrate.
Yeah, I
know. Exactly.
Yeah, I hear that all the time, too. Well, why don't you go back to Europe? And it's like, well, they're prioritizing non-whites in Europe. There's plenty of German Americans who would love to go back to Germany, but they actually can't get in. And I hear from those people, they're trying to get back to Europe, and they won't take them back. They won't let them in. It's outrageous.
It is. It's, we're not allowed to even call that what it is, which is discrimination.
Well, getting back to your little workshop you did there, another question for you. You know, liberalism, it's puritanical, it's religious, like you said, it's very emotional. So how do you deal with some of these people that are, you know, puritanical, religious nuts about some of their ideology? How do you fight back in those scenarios?
Those people aren't worth fighting. They're ideologues. They don't care what the truth is. They care about believing what they want to believe. I mean, it's like any other religion. Are you ever going to argue a hardcore Christian out of their beliefs?
No.
You won't. Like, they're really emotionally invested in believing that, and you would bring their whole world down if you destroyed that. They have no incentive to listen to you and every incentive not to. So don't waste time trying to convert people like that. They're just, they're a lost cause, and, you know, let's just cross our fingers and hope they don't breed.
Yeah, I agree. 100%. Now, what are the people you think right now, looking at America, are people that you think that we could convert? Like, I look at the Trump patriot, you know, civic nationalist demographic, which is huge. And I'm like, you're so close, but you need to come a little farther this way, you know, connect the dots. What is Western civilization? It's white civilization, right? So any tips on how to start winning some of those people over? How do we appeal to that demographic?
You have to be patient. I don't believe in pushing people along. They need to come to it of their own realization, because if you're just forcing it on them, there is going to be kind of a natural resistance, because it's going to be very obvious that you have an agenda with them. But you can just talk honestly with them. Be honest about the situation and how you see it. Tell them how scared you are about the future, why you're scared about the future. That's particularly effective with people who have children. With people who don't have children or don't want children, that sort of loses its effectiveness because they don't have a stake in the future, and it's more about their own immediate comforts for their lifetime. You can bring up the point that, you know, you don't trust other races to be as kind to us as we have been to them. There's plenty of examples in the world that you can use to point out how that's true. But also, you've got to listen to them. You know, don't just preach at them. You
yeah.
have to listen to what they believe and where they're at. Because if you're not willing to listen to them, and by listen, I mean truly listen, not just waiting to talk, you're not going to have any luck converting them, because you're not going to know at what point you need to meet them. So at the start, it's a lot more important to listen and ask questions than it is to start throwing facts and figures at them and telling them what you think and feel. It's not about you. It's about the other person. And if if you want to change somebody's mind, you have to keep that in mind, that it is about them. What do they want? What are their desires? What are their motivations? Once you know those things, you can start shifting their priorities, because you can start poking holes in what they believe and saying, well, you say you have, you know, this priority, but that doesn't really line up with this belief that you said you had, and here's why. Yeah. But it's a long, slow process. You just have to gently massage these ideas into them, and they have to accept them of their own accord. And not everybody will. That's okay. We don't actually need everybody. We just need most people.
And the other thing is, asking questions. If you ask the right questions, you don't even have to actually say much. Like, for instance, why is it that all white countries and only white countries are being forced to take in tons of non-Europeans and mass immigration? What is so good about multiculturalism, right? I mean, you can ask these questions to kind of get the gears moving in their heads, to get them to think some things that maybe they haven't thought about before. I remember before I came into these topics, you know, just seeing some of those questions posed kind of got things moving around in my head. I don't know if it was that way for you.
I didn't really have anybody to sort of talk to me about it. I very much just red-pilled myself almost in a vacuum. I didn't know anyone else with those beliefs or anything. And this was, you know, before it was really widespread on the internet. There were very few resources to look for. I really should have paid more attention to how I did it back then, because I didn't realize that, you know, 10 years down the road, things were going to be so much different. But it's just when they bring up these things like that multiculturalism is good, like, well, how is it good for you? How is it good for your neighborhood? How is it affecting your children's school? How's it affecting your employment opportunities? How's it affecting your housing prices? Because if you can make it personal, if you're just talking about, oh, they're bringing gang violence to some other state in another part of the country, that's not personal to them. It needs to be about how it affects them on their daily life, because most people can't think too much bigger than their own personal sphere.
Yeah. Especially with America, because it's become just hyper individualism, right? So it's got to be something that appeals to their selfishness. I feel like a lot of people, they don't become political until they have to, until it personally affects their home or their work or their field, right?
Absolutely. Because if you're comfortable, why would you want to change the status quo? Especially if you are, you're married, you've got a stable job, you've got kids, you know, if you're a man, you don't want to rock the boat. And I tell this a lot to men who want to talk about these issues. If they're single men, they just want to talk about war and fighting and winning. And I'm sure that's very exciting for a young single man, but it's not so exciting to a middle-aged married man who has a wife and children who are depending on him to be the breadwinner. Why on earth would he stick his neck out and risk losing his job?
Yeah.
That war is not appealing to them. And they don't want that for their kids. So you need to talk about what is appealing to them, which is a future for their children and stability for them. Yeah. It's like, well, maybe it has to get worse before it gets better. But, you know, the outcome will result in greater long-term stability and a better future for your children and your grandchildren and so on and so forth.
In this day and age, warfare is very different. I mean, back then it was warriors. They literally fought for land. They literally fought in blood. They had weapons that would take each other out and settle the score right there. But now we're dealing with a whole other kind of warfare. So we have to be thinking a little bit differently, right?
Yes. I mean, it's a culture war. It's a psychological war. Whether or not it erupts into an actual physical violent war, I don't know. I mean, I'm a woman, so I hope not, but it's probably not going to be up to me. And when you're fighting kind of a war of minds, you know, you've got to be sly and you've got to be clever and you've got to have your head on straight. You've got to have your stuff sorted out so you can help other people sort their stuff out.
I agree. Well, let's talk about white guilt. Where do you think it started to seep into the minds of white people, and who do you think was behind pushing it initially?
Well, I think, first of all, there's an assumption that all races feel guilt equally. And I don't know that that's actually the case. Not a lot of cultures have this guilt-driven ethos. Guilt isn't the same as shame. Shame is external pressures, whereas guilt is internal and self-directed. So guilt gives us the ability for self-improvement. And it's kind of been our Achilles heel, because considering how powerful Europeans have historically been, all non-Europeans are going to have an interest in guilt-tripping Europeans because it is a weakness of ours, even though it's also a source of our great personal strength. And so I think white guilt has always been this seed in us because it's just part of who we are, this capacity to feel guilt, this capacity for self-reflection, this idea that if you feel guilt, it should motivate you to do better the next time. And that's really easy for anyone who wants to manipulate you to exploit. Even other white people can use that to manipulate you.
Now, you mentioned guilt as a strength. Can you expand more on that? How do you see that as a strength? For me, I've never seen it as a strength in my life. I've actually felt great when I can shed any kind of guilt. But yeah, having a conscience, I guess, having a conscience is quite different than guilt.
Well, your conscience is related to guilt. If you're feeling guilty and you're feeling guilty because you've done wrong, then that's an appropriate time to feel guilt. And feeling guilty, it doesn't feel nice, but it can motivate you to do better the next time. You could say, well, I made the wrong choice here. I did something that was immoral, or I did something that was wrong. I did something that hurt someone else or that hurt me, and I need to make better choices going forward. If you don't have that, you are totally reliant on other people shaming you to do the right thing. And there's a place for shame too. But if you don't have any internally self-directed guilt, then how are you ever going to feel motivated to better yourself as a person? And if you don't feel motivated to better yourself as a person, where are you going to get the motivation to better your society as a whole?
Yeah. Do you think that there are some tribes of people or races of people that don't feel as much guilt? It'd be interesting to have studies about that.
It would be fascinating to have a study on that. I do vaguely remember encountering a study on Europeans and Japanese, and those, as far as I know, are the only ones who have been studied and shown to have guilt. But of course, this isn't something that academia, as it currently stands, is ever going to pursue. But we don't necessarily have evidence that other races feel guilt the way we do. But we assume that they do. And when you assume that they all feel guilt the way we do, then you can start projecting your experiences and the way you think onto them. Because we as Europeans are very guilt-motivated people. But that doesn't mean everyone else is. And it's probably not actually a good idea to assume they are without any evidence.
Well, since you're quite philosophical and sounds like you've studied a little bit of psychology, how do you begin to unravel this white guilt then? I mean, you know all the same bullshit lines, right? As an American, slavery, colonialism, Jim Crow, blah, blah, blah. These are the things that are beaten over, you know, white kids' heads in school. Oh, the Holocaust, yeah. Right? And then they live with this guilt and this shame, and they feel they can't assert themselves because this and this and that, or whatever they think happened a few hundred years ago. So how do you begin to unravel that in their minds?
Well, it's a sins of the father fallacy. If your father murdered somebody, should we put you in jail for it just because he got away with it? I mean, yeah. Nobody in their right mind would agree to that, it's patently unfair, but somehow it gets twisted when you start talking about things like colonialism and slavery, and you start saying all white people are guilty. So that's an example of guilt being used to manipulate you because it's inappropriate guilt. You don't actually have a reason to feel guilty because you didn't actually do anything wrong. And to feel guilt on behalf of somebody else is not appropriate guilt.
Yeah, I think a lot of these kids just need their parents to say that, but a lot of these parents are just absent and they just let the schools teach whatever. You know, I was just with some friends yesterday and we were all recalling how in school we were seeing pictures of, you know, or not pictures, but imagery of Holocaust survivors, and there would always be a Holocaust survivor who would come in and talk to the kids when they're like 10 years old, telling them stories about this. I mean, it's really pushed in their heads from a young age. And then they already start feeling guilty about those things at 10 years old. And it's quite traumatic hearing some of those stories as well. But there needs to be a mom and a dad at home who's, you know, keeping an eye on what this curriculum is and kind of setting the kids straight so that this guilt doesn't seep in there and continue into adulthood.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate that I was not in a school that was big enough to have that kind of stuff. But I think most people my age were exposed to that. And the problem is that their parents were exposed to it too. So we're about four generations deep into the Cold War subversion of the U.S. education system. Yes. Well, Western education in general, because they didn't just target the U.S. So you've got you've got, you know, three or four generations of people that have been totally brainwashed by this and have never been given an alternative viewpoint. So even if parents are paying attention to what their children are learning in school, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to see anything wrong with it because they were taught the same thing and don't know any different.
Now, this is always the big question. Is this mess that we're in? We've allowed all these anti-white politics to flourish. We're self-hating as a people. We've opened the doors to, globalism, mass immigration. Have we collectively done this to ourselves? Or do you think that there are, you know, subversive groups among us who are pushing for it? How do you tackle this question?
There are definitely subversive groups among us who push for those things, but we allow them to continue to operate. I mean, I hate to say this because I do value Western traditions of freedom, but if you're going to have that, then you need to be very careful of who you let in to share in that. And this is kind of the problem with open societies. They are very open to those subversive elements. They're very easy to come in and undermine. The only way to keep them out is basically to clamp down on a lot of freedoms, or at least have very, very closed borders, a very closed society. I mean, North Korea probably doesn't have a problem with subversion.
Yeah, they definitely do. It's funny, they're commie, but they're very nationalistic, aren't they? I mean, everyone there has black hair. They all look the same.
And I mean, that was how the communists, the Soviets operated, was you find an open society, you start putting in all these subversive elements because you can't subvert a society that isn't open. And as soon as it becomes communist, you then close it. You clamp down, it becomes a completely closed society. So all the things that they pushed into Western societies, they didn't actually want in their own communist countries because they knew it was subversive. And when they took over, they would clean those elements out. I mean, the subversive people think they're going to be in charge. In reality, they were just lined up and shot.
I mean, some of these subversive groups, what they're doing, how they're trying to transform European countries, do you think that in their minds they really think it's going to be like a Brazilian utopia, or is it more sinister than that? Is it really about crushing us, a possible fear of the rise of fascism or actual hatred of white people? What do you think some of their motives would be?
I think it's some of both. I think there are people who really are just useful idiots and don't know what they're doing, like, they haven't really thought about it. Maybe they really do think that what they're fighting for is a good thing and that it's all going to work out really well in the end. Other people, I think, are actually just motivated by hatred of Europeans and European culture as well, obviously.
Oh, definitely. And I've heard some people say, well, you know, no, we can't have nationalism because that leads to war. It's like, look around, forcing people to live with each other and, you know, people mass migrating into other people's countries, or, you know, us invading other countries and bringing them democracy, I mean, with bombs. That's what's creating all the tension, right?
Yeah, well, it's the old equation, diversity plus proximity equals conflict. you don't have racial conflict when you have segregated societies.
Yeah, it's really quite simple. People are talking about, let's end racism and let's end oppression. Okay, we'll just give all these groups their own countries. Actually, they all have them. We're the only ones who don't. And then everyone looks like you, and then it ends racism. Then you won't be complaining anymore, right? You won't have to complain about those awful white people because they won't be around you anymore.
Exactly. And that would make a lot of sense. And the fact is that the people who push multiculturalism, like the elites who push it, are not actually interested in like any kind of multiracial utopia. They know that it's a destabilizing element of society. And that's why they push it. The more societies is destabilized, the greater the interest in and the popular opinion is for greater state power and regulations, and the more they can just move in and do what they want with us little people.
I noticed, too, there's the capitalist element. These mega corporations, they love it because it's more people coming in drinking Coke and eating the burgers, and they don't question things like white people who go shop at Whole Foods and want to know what they're eating, who boycott companies, right? Some of these people that come in, they just think it's wonderful, these strip malls and these big box stores and these chains. They just gobble it all up. They don't ask any questions. They're just really good consumers, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you... You certainly don't see advertisements on TV telling you to buy less. it's all about the dollars. And, you know, I don't know. You know, I think we don't really benefit from buying all this stuff and giving these companies so much say so in the economy. But it's just the way it is.
Yeah, I can't stand it when I see a lot of these strip malls and I drive around and these new towns that are being formed in America that are just rootless and no architecture, just strip malls just to be able to house the influx of this new population that's migrating over here. I mean, we have over a million a year legally. That doesn't include all the illegals. So now we're going to be chopping down the forests and building strip malls to be able to house all these people. And then people say it's great because the economy is growing and they're just building more and more and more strip malls. You know, it's just, it's a nightmare. What point does it end? At what point is this going to collapse? And could this even continue if there weren't white people propping it up, right?
Well, I don't think it would continue with white people propping it up because in, you know, countries like America, white people pay the vast majority of taxes. So who's going to continue propping up the non-whites once they're not around to pay taxes anymore, or if they just decide that they're going to stop working? So the idea that immigrants are a positive to the economy, maybe only in the very, very short term. I think there's some really, there's some legitimate questions that could be asked about their benefit to the economy and whether or not they're actually a net drain.
Yeah, and then I hate the, oh, well, they do all the jobs that you don't want to do. That's bullshit. Now they're employed in every single sector that Americans are, from top to bottom and everything in between. I mean, it's ridiculous. And there's not even enough jobs for our people that are in this country already, you know?
Yeah, well, the demand for low-skill, low-IQ labor is at an all-time low. Many jobs could be automated. What use do we have for importing a whole bunch of people with double-digit IQs? We're not going to need them going forward. These jobs Americans won't do. Well, if we didn't have immigrants there doing them, there would be a greater push for automation anyway. Like, it's not like we don't have the technology and we're moving in that direction anyway. So I think that's, again, that's just very intellectually dishonest to say that they do the jobs we don't do and we need them for the economy, because we did just fine we had them there. And we will do just fine again. And you know what? Let's say it's true. Let's say that they're good for the economy. I will happily take a hit to my living standards. I would not even complain.
Yeah. I mean, come on. We've gone to the moon. We've gone into space. We've gone deep down into the ocean. Now we're inventing robots that flip the damn burgers and are cleaning. I mean, I was just looking at a vacuum the other day that cleans itself. That's pretty high tech and it's not that much money. So they're coming around. Eventually we'll have robots that clean, and I'd love to own one of those, you know, save some time so that we can do some more shows on anti-white politics, right?
Yeah, well, I do have a robot vacuum cleaner, but I have to say it didn't live up to the hype.
Oh, that's too bad. Is it like bumping things and scuffing things and awkwardly moving?
Yeah, it doesn't do a very good job of navigating. And my hope was that the cat would ride on it and he could be a YouTube star riding on the Roomba, but he's afraid of it, so that didn't work out.
Oh boy. The other thing I always hear too is, well, with white people becoming a minority and the birth rate comes up, well, you guys aren't having any babies. You need to have more babies. Well, here's the thing though. Even if we're all having 5-6 babies, they're still coming in at a rate that like we still can't keep up with. The majority of the world is not white. White people are a minority. So we'd have to be just breeding like rabbits constantly to be able to keep up with this inflow. And is population wars, is that really where it should go, thinking long-term with the resources and whatnot? Because I think even with the smaller white population, if it becomes white, you know, we ebb and we flow the white population in the past, and that's just how it is. Doesn't mean that it's the end for us. I think if anything, we do kind of need to become trimmer and more fit, and whites kind of need a little bit of a reset. Would you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. And I don't think that just having more and more kids is ever going to be the answer, because no matter what we do, we're still vastly outnumbered. And even if we all have 5 or 6 kids, even if all the non-whites still all have 5 or 6 kids, again, we're not really moving the needle. There are ways to deal with that don't involve using people like livestock. And that's closing the borders and deporting immigrants and saying these lands are for white people, for white children, and for a white future. And, you know, I'm not even convinced that it's necessarily good for people to have that many children, which I know is probably going to be a really unpopular thing to say on your channel, but I'm not one of those people that goes around and says, have as many kids as you can. I'm more have as many kids as you think you can handle and you can afford and raise them really, really well.
Well, that's very important, of course. You have to be able to take care of the ones that you do have properly. And not everyone can handle as many. Some parents can and some can't. So it has to be what's right for you as long as you're having them.
Yeah, absolutely. Some parents do a fantastic job with large families, and some parents struggle to just cope with one or two. It's a very personal choice, and I don't think that it's something that we need to be judging each other about.
Yep, I agree. Well, let's talk about the points you brought up in your video, what the left gets right. So what are some things you think that they get right?
It was such a short video because there's not very many things. Probably the biggest thing is my perception is that the left is a lot more supportive of each other than the right wing is. Good number of people want to be the center of attention and they want all the praise for themselves and be held up as this alt-right thought leader. It's kind of like, the leftists are busy playing soccer. They're working together as a team for a common goal and they don't really care who kicks the ball into the goal. Right-wingers are busy playing tennis and not even doubles tennis. They're solo and it's like, look at me, I want to be the best. And I think it's not a very helpful attitude to have. Having a lot of people who are very ego-driven means that they're making it about themselves, not about what's best for the cause. And also I think the left is, just kind of dovetailing off that, they're very united in their purpose. They don't sit there arguing about which enemy they should prioritize. Whichever one, they commit crimes of opportunity. You know, if they see a target, they just go for it. They don't sit there strategizing about whether or not that's the best target to attack at this particular time. It's like, look, there's low-hanging fruit. Let's take it. And the right will just sit there and be like, well, I'm not going to help you fight your enemy because I want to take care of mine first. You know, there's no point doing anything about the Muslims if we haven't done something about immigration and borders and the welfare state. And, well, there's no point doing anything about that if we haven't taken care of the Jews yet. And it's just this constant arguing and infighting about what's more important. And it's like, who cares? If you've got a target, just go for it.
Yeah.
Like, if you're out target shooting, you don't sit there and wait for the perfect bird. You take the one that comes along first and is the closest.
Yeah, it's true. I get tired of it too. It's just, can we just focus on the fucking goal, the big picture, and stop nitpicking with people on your side? This is in high school. Okay, this is survival. This is the future of our people. And sometimes I wonder too.
Exactly.
Sometimes I wonder too if there aren't some agitators or, you know, GIDF, you know, Tel Aviv in the basement kind of stuff happening with some of the comments and some of the things that I see happening and some of the attacks, because we really are in the spotlight right now. I mean, there's all kinds of enemies that are swarming around and wanting to infiltrate into the alt-right. So sometimes I wonder some of that isn't stirred up. But if it is sincere, I gotta cut that crap out. Always invest your time and your energy slamming the enemy, not people who are on your side, not people who are 90% on your side or 60% or 50% on your side. Always slam at the enemy with all your energy. I remember I had Arthur Kemp on, and he too was basically telling me that the worst attacks he's had has been people from his own side.
Yeah, I've experienced the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is bull. Yeah, that's got to go. And those kinds of people who act like that, maybe they need to be shamed out to the outer circles, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, unfortunately, we'd be getting rid of a lot of people on our team if we did that, I think. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's about survival. This isn't a game. If you want to play a game where you're sitting there thinking about the best strategy, go and set up a game of Risk with your friends and leave the rest of us to do serious adult business of saving Western civilization. We don't have time to sit around and argue about what's the best strategy and when it should best be implemented. I mean, things change. You have to do what's expedient and what's convenient and what works at the time. You know, I support people that I don't agree with 100%. We're all travelers on the same train. Some people might get off a few stops before we want to. We might get off a few stops before someone else does. But, you know, until we get to our stop, there's no reason that we can't work together. And as you say, focus on the big picture.
Yeah, and it's also about being understanding of new people that come in too. I've seen some people, just to critique a little bit on the alt-right, I've seen some new people come in and maybe they don't have a sterling past, or they made some mistakes in the past and they get attacked for that. When they've actually come around, they wake up to these things later on in their life, they realize a lot of us have been fooled by Marxist anti-white propaganda. We've gone to liberal schools. So you got to cut some people some slack by the time they get here. If they've done some stupid things in their past or made stupid decisions, you know, we all have a process of growth. We all wisen up. We all learn as we go. And there needs to be some compassion and understanding and sensitivity for the new people that come in. Because if you act like a steel fist and puritanical and religious and hardcore with them, that's going to scare people away.
Absolutely. And I have heard some kind of newcomers to the movement say that, you know, they don't feel like it's a very welcoming movement, and they feel very out of place. They feel judged for their past, or that they're not on board with all the same ideas. And it's like, if you've got somebody coming who wants to be in your club at a time when we really need members, you take that person by the hand and you answer all their questions and you be really nice to them.
Exactly.
Like, they have made the effort to come to our side on their own. Don't drive them away.
That is correct. Yeah, I had a guest on recently, and she was talking about her past and how she went to Berklee School of Music, and she was basically brainwashed by a lot of propaganda, and she thought, oh, I have to date a mixed race person. That's the right thing to do. And she did that, and she realized he was an illegal alien, right? But she's...
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes. And I listened to that one the other day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she got a lot of hell for that. I noticed a lot of hell for that. And even though she's a beautiful woman who's on our side, who married a Norwegian man, has a beautiful Norwegian child, she's got her face out there, her name out there, and she's one of us. So anytime I see comments like that, I think, okay, some of these have got to be JIDF, Bitter MGTOW, but if they are on our side, you know, shame on you for attacking a beautiful woman such as that, who fessed up about her past, who's come around, who's on our side. That kind of shit has to stop, I think.
Exactly. And I mean, she's done already a lot more than a lot of those haters will have. I mean, as you say, she's put her face and name out there. She's had children. Just because she's made a few mistakes in the past, and this is true for anyone who's made a few mistakes, as long as they're doing it correctly now, then they should be commended for that. I mean, some of those people have had to come a much further way to get where they are than, you know, somebody like maybe myself has. I didn't have to travel that far to get here. But people who are coming from a very far left or liberal background, where they may have been brainwashed by those ideas, they've had a tougher road to follow.
That is correct. So we've got to keep these things in mind, folks, because we do have to be welcoming. We want all the recruits that we can get. We want people to feel like they have a tribe, they have good friends, they have family, they have people that watch their backs, not judge them like basically how liberals do, puritanical liberals. If everything isn't just so, then you can't be part of our group. We can't be like that, can't be like them. You know, and there's a tendency, sometimes people, if they study something that they hate for too long, they kind of start becoming the thing that they hate. So there's the danger of that too. So you can't become the thing that you hate.
Yes.
Another good video you brought up was about canceling Netflix, and I agree 100%. I hate it when I hear that some nationalists I talk to, or I see people tweeting about, oh, on Netflix, I saw this. Why are you people still supporting Netflix? I mean, the owner of Netflix is an anti-white globalist, so why are you giving him your money, and why are you supporting this crap, filth programming coming out of Netflix? So tell us why they should cancel it.
Yeah, well, it's tough to find companies to support that aren't run by SJWs anymore, but I'm actually just anti-TV in general. I have not had a TV in many years. Best decision I ever made. It is such a waste of time. I don't see the point in paying money to have degeneracy streamed into my home. I mean, and what a waste of time. I can't watch TV because I feel too guilty about not doing something more productive. So if I do have to watch it, I like 30 minutes is probably my limit. And then I'm like, no, I've got to go do something else. But, you know, the amount of time that some people spend watching TV absolutely boggles my mind, how they can spend that much time on something so passive. Go read a book, go write an article, go meet people in the real world, or like, cook yourself a healthy meal. Like, I don't know, like, just do something that's not watching TV, because you're not learning anything from it. And you're just having all of these really subversive ideas put into your mind. Even people who are red-pilled still need to watch with caution.
Yeah, it's true. Absolutely. I like to do certain reviews for people so I can, you have to kind of teach some people who are newcomers to this to what to look out for. You have to teach people how to think, how to see the programming that's coming out, you know. So I like to use it for review purposes if I take a certain show or whatever, but I don't pay for it. There's some people that actually go they'll actually go and pay. Like, I saw a lot of people go pay to see Star Wars in the movie theater while they're talking about, oh my God, it was so anti-white and anti-. I was like, well, you gave them your $15 or whatever, you know, why'd you do that?
Yeah. I think my last straw in terms of even streaming a lot of stuff online was the Vikings show.
Yep.
Which
I saw that.
And I have noticed that shows like that are becoming a little bit more popular, and they start out really well. And it's like, oh, this is fantastic. They're finally making a show that portrays our history in,
and then he dates an Asian,
positive and interesting light. Well, yeah, first, you know, there's infidelity, and then there's race mixing, and I hear now there's some homosexuality.
Oh, Lagertha, she has a girlfriend. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have not watched past the first season or so, because it was just, I'm not going to support that kind of degeneracy and mocking of our cultural heritage.
Of course, exactly. That's when you turn it off at that point, like, screw you, you know? Yeah, and there's a lot of that being made now, I see. And it's almost like they're delighting in it. And I've seen some producers make comments about that. Like, they almost want to kind of twist it into, they want to bug the alt-right, they want to bug nationalists and pro-whites, so they make this content and then kind of throw in some of this filth in there just to agitate them. And I've actually seen producers tweet things about that. So they're knowingly doing that, too.
Okay, well, I haven't seen the tweets or anything, but I don't follow it that closely. But I think it has become a common formula to have, you know, the first season or two of a show like that be quite appealing. And then they gradually start introducing things like, oh, maybe you'll suddenly see a few black extras among the Vikings.
There was a lot of them.
And then, you know, the occasional race mixing or homosexuality or, you know, whatever other disgusting stuff they can think of.
Yeah, there were no Vikings. Well, let's talk about some misconceptions and stereotypes about nationalist women and their relationships with men. Some things that we see kind of pushed by the opposition all the time, right? You and I, or we must be brainwashed or controlled by men or chained to the stove. What are some things that you encounter that are ridiculous?
You know, maybe some of those stereotypes are true for some people. Stereotypes don't come out of nowhere, but I think those stereotypes are actually more based in like the 1950s conception of the housewife, which was a historical anomaly to say the least. In terms of the women and men's relationships, I think the last video I'd put up about female hypergamy got a lot of hate from the MGTOWs. I think somebody shared it on a men's rights subreddit or something.
Yeah, they're always buttered about something some woman says. Yeah.
They were triggered by the title, and a lot of them didn't even watch the video. They just downvoted it.
Of course.
But there's this idea that the only reason why white women won't date white men is because of feminism. That's like, well, no, that's not true. I mean, many white men are lazy and weak, and we don't need feminism to turn us off those men.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of these white men are using feminism as an excuse to hate white women in general, but feminists don't speak for all white women, and they don't even speak for most white women. I think something like fewer than 20% of women of all colors agree that they're a feminist. And I kind of think, you know, white men need to stop listening to this feminist propaganda and start learning to listen to real white women.
Exactly.
Like, don't listen to what the feminists are telling you that women want. Like, we're nationalist women. Listen to us. Like,
yeah, the majority of exactly. And the majority of white women in America voted for Trump. Okay, so just because CNN shows some women's march and is like, oh my God, you know, all these women are feminists, don't believe it. I mean, it's all just hype. The majority of women really aren't feminists. It, like you said, it really is a small, loud group, and the fake news just likes to prop them up like they're this huge demographic, but it's not true.
Yeah. And I mean, feminism is, it's anti-white. It's trying to divide white men and women and destroy the family unit. And when I encounter white men who take feminists seriously, I'm just like, I just kind of want to grab their head and like turn them toward me and be like, read my lips. I'm telling you, we don't all want to marry billionaires. We don't all want to sleep around. Like, a lot of us are happy just to marry a normal guy and have a normal family with children in a modest house. Like, we're not all gold diggers.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times I have to say it.
Yeah, you almost feel sorry for some of those beta male MGTOW guys. You know, that's exactly what our enemies would want, right? Exactly what they want. White men to walk away from white women and say, screw you forever, and I'm not going to have kids, and I'm going to go gay now. That's exactly what the enemies, they would love that. They're delighting. They're rubbing their palms about that idea right now, right?
Yeah, and I mean, whatever MGTOWs align themselves with politically, I still do sort of see them as an enemy, just like feminism. They're anti-family. They're trying to turn men away from having families. They're pitting them against white women. They're telling them that all white women are horrible and evil and just want their money and will marry them and take their children later. And this is just simply not true. I don't care what they say, it's not true. And for them to be telling men this at a time when we have a demographic crisis tells me that they are not on our side.
Exactly. And there has been a few MGTOW guys who have wisened up and they have come to our side and they've seen, oh yeah, duh, these people that are talking, you and I, we're providing an answer, something that can make men happy, make women happy. We're trying to unify them, make them happy again. But we're also, one thing I hear a lot of lefties say, and I get this question a lot, oh, are you trying to go back to the 1950s? No one's trying to go back to the 1950s. Are you, as a woman, trying to go back to the 1950s?
No, I don't think I'd actually like to be that kind of woman. And I don't, maybe that's not the norm among nationalist women, but I don't really fancy just like being at home and cooking and raising kids all day. Like, I need a little bit more intellectual stimulation than that.
And this is where the alt-right woman is different. And I've been telling a lot of people that there's a lot of, you know, kind of fashy housewives and they're raising their kids right. But a lot of us alt-right women, we need a little intellectual meat. We need to be involved in the fight. You know, I don't know, I think of us more as a little bit more of a shield maiden influence, right? Maybe some of the Viking or ancient European kind of women who were involved in different things. But no, we don't want to just be chained to the stove. This is a war. We have to step up. We have to all contribute in different ways. I mean, this is, we're being pushed against the wall. You know, this is a dire time. Also, the 1950s, by then, I mean, it was really not a good time. I mean, we killed a bunch of Germans. You know, Germans in America are killing Germans overseas. America had already been infested. You know, a lot of Soviets came in, a lot of cultural Marxists were already coming into the university. They also started building up that cookie cutter kind of neighborhood. It was actually Jewish developers who started that, and that cookie cutter tract kind of home. So there's a lot of things I don't like about it. The one good thing I did like is the average size woman was a size 4, you know, it was pretty white, family units were healthy, it wasn't degenerate. So there's certain things that we like, but no one's trying to go back to the 1950s. We don't have a time machine. I think that we want to take different things from the past, from all kinds of generations, and infuse them into the current year, right?
Exactly. And I don't think that, I mean, look, you know, keeping house and raising children is just part of life if you want to have a family, but I don't think that needs to be any woman's be all and end all. I don't know too many men who would even ask that of their wives, or too many women who want just that for themselves. I'm sure there are some, and that's fine if that's what they want. There's nothing wrong with that. But I can only speak for myself personally, but that's not what I'm fighting to bring back. And I mean, historically, women have often worked outside the home and have been involved in, even if not in politics, in their society and culture in other ways. As you say, chained to the stove, it's not a realistic expectation. And I've never actually heard anybody say that that's what they're after.
Exactly. It took teamwork in the past, right? It took two to survive and you kind of work it out in a marriage. You find what works right by still keeping that feminine masculine balance. At least that's what works for me. There's certain things that I like, there's certain things he likes, and together it just works. And I think it's personal between a couple. I think the most important thing is that we raise our kids right and we fight for the future of our people. I've met all kinds of different alt-right couples in different situations, some where actually the woman makes more money, some where the man's actually a better cook. So there's all kinds of different combos. I don't think we have to be just strapped down into some rigid mode. As long as the family unit is cared for, I think that's the most important part.
Exactly.
So what makes you and I different, you think, as women, that we can see through these lies of multiculturalism, but a lot of other women can't? I know this is a hard question, and I always think about this, but what makes us different?
It is a hard question, and I think I really struggle to find other women like this. I don't know if it's just a question of having like more of a man brain than most women have.
Yeah, I've questioned that too.
I don't think it necessarily has to do with testosterone, but I think it's going to be different for a lot of people. We all kind of have our different path that we take to get here. And I think some of us are just naturally, like, if you've got a higher IQ or something, you're going to be naturally more curious. You're going to be more interested in these kind of topics. You're going to be more interested in finding the truth, I think. I think a lot of us have had, you know, real life experience with being treated badly by non-whites, like particularly like as women, or even as blonde women, especially the way that we get treated by non-white men. A lot of us have been bullied for being white. I've been picked on for having blonde hair.
That's coveted around the world, the kind of blonde hair you have. Like other countries, they would like kill to have that. You know?
No, I recall waiting at the bus stop once in university, and I just missed the bus and had to wait another half hour. So I got out one of my textbooks and started studying. And some random guy just came up to me and said, "I didn't know Barbies could read."
It's always that stereotype too that you know who in Hollywood has pushed too, and I think it's all out of envy and jealousy. Let's portray all blondes as stupid airheads and sluts, right?
Yeah, and I mean the statistics say that blondes have a slightly higher IQ than the average, so nice. It's the idea that blondes are dumb, it just doesn't bear out in the evidence. And I think also another reason is that a lot of people on the alt-right seem to come from kind of traumatic family backgrounds. And nationalism is kind of the extension of family values. And if you didn't have that growing up and you're looking for it, it's conceivable that you might find nationalism very attractive to sort of, you know, recreate those values that you have, but that just weren't born out in your family. And I think also some women just aren't as concerned with the politics, but more so with self-interest, and they just see traditionalism as being a gain for them and the lifestyle that they want. So I think it really varies a lot from person to person and what their motivations are and what their background has been.
Yeah, I've said this before, but I think the majority of women aren't really truly convinced in politics either way, and you can actually reason with them. A man that she's really interested in can easily influence her and persuade her. Generally, it's a small sect of women that's actually really interested in politics, and as we see a lot of the women that do rise to the top, I mean, Ann Coulter, she's older, she's single, no kids. Theresa May had no kids. Merkel had no kids. The first, I think it was in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the female prime ministers, many without kids. So it is kind of, they have to take on a more of a male role, just kind of stepping into that male side of themselves. And that's quite exhausting for a lot of women. I know for me, propping that up would be quite exhausting. I would be miserable always being in that masculine mindset, you know?
Well, I think for women, you know, you can't have it all. If you want to be successful in some kind of intellectual endeavor or in a career, you are probably going to have to sacrifice family. And if you want to have a family, you probably need to accept that you're not going to be at the top of your field in whatever is your area of interest, which is probably, you know, we see these politicians who have risen to the top and they don't have kids, but they've probably had to invest most of their life into getting where they are, and they just didn't have time for a family.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some great thinkers that we know too, Sam Dixon, there's several others that they actually didn't have the opportunity to have kids. You know, they gave their whole life to the movement. And I know there's been other philosophical thinkers like that in the past, some great European writers who have influenced a lot of alt-right thought who they unfortunately didn't have kids either.
Yeah, and that seems to be really common where historically somebody who has had great intellectual achievements to contribute to our culture did not really end up leaving behind a family or not much of one. And, you know, I don't actually have a problem with that. I'd like to see their genes passed on, but we need great thinkers just as much as we need more children. There's no point in having more children if we're not even going to continue to develop our cultures to have something to hand down to them.
That is correct. Well, last question for you. You know, what are some things we can all be doing right now to fight back, no matter who you are? What do you think? There's people out there, I want to help. What can they do?
The most important thing is probably just speaking out wherever you get the chance, because if we all remain silent, we get nowhere. And I think, you know, when the Trump train went through, a lot of people jumped on board. They felt more empowered to speak out. And now these ideas are much more commonplace. I actually feel really heartened reading the comments section of any news article, because they're usually overwhelmingly right wing now. And it doesn't take a lot of effort. And even if you don't want to put your name and face out there publicly, there is no excuse not to talk privately to your friends and family. Like, that is the bare minimum that anyone can do, is just talk about your ideas with people who aren't on board yet. It's probably not a lot of use to just sit there talking amongst people who are already converted. You're preaching to the choir. You do need to kind of go and put yourself out there with people who don't agree with you. I think that's probably a little bit harder for women who are more conflict averse. And I think it's really great that we've seen more women speaking out lately. I don't think we can have too many women talking about these issues. I don't care if they're dumb and have nothing original to contribute. I'd still want to see them out there talking. I don't think they probably would be dumb and unoriginal if they're on our side, but like, it's just, it's a numbers thing. It's a perception thing. Like, if you feel compelled to write an article or put yourself on YouTube or start tweeting, like, just go do it. Like, it looks so much better to have all of these women out there talking about these same things, because it kind of gives the social okay for other women to come on board.
Yes.
That doesn't happen when it's only men talking. And I have seen some people complaining that women get more attention than the men who are talking about the same thing.
It's always been that way, boys.
You
know, the world responds to beauty. That's just how it is, right?
That is just how it is. And that's, I can understand their frustration if they think they have good ideas that are going unnoticed. But women who speak out about these things are, I think, kind of a gateway. And if you can listen to the women talk, who tend to talk a little bit less deeply than the men do, then you can kind of move on to the men who are really digging deep into this stuff and go further down the rabbit hole. There's a lot of women out there who are excellent resources to use to share with your friends and family, who go very gently on these topics. They're wonderful in what they do. And I really like to support those women. So encourage your female friends and family to speak out, especially, but it's good for everybody in general. And also just speak out against bad ideas in the movement, like this white Sharia thing that's going around.
Yeah, what the hell is that? Yeah, well, I've seen it pop up, unfortunately. I don't know how. I generally stay away from comments because it's just, ugh, what's the point? It's a jungle, you know, but I have come across that.
I wasn't sure at first if it was serious, but I'm told by some male friends who are part of secret men's groups that white Sharia is talked about openly and seriously as a viable option. And it's like, let me get this straight. So you're going to destroy European values and culture with a foreign ideology in order to save our identity? Like, how do you save something by destroying it?
It sounds like some kind of control thing. Well, a real alpha male doesn't have to do that. He just leads by example.
Exactly.
And then the woman just follows. Yeah.
It's a beta male reproductive strategy. I can't get women to come to me voluntarily, so let's just force them.
Exactly.
These ideas are toxic and they need to be rooted out.
Yes.
they should not be allowed to become mainstream ideas in this movement, if for no other reason than it is incredibly off-putting to any newcomers.
Yes.
If you are a newcomer and you've come to it by way of being upset about the Islamic invasion of Europe, hearing about white Sharia isn't going to convince you to stay.
Exactly. You need women to have a future of a movement, because you need to make babies with these women. So doing things to scare off women coming in is a really retarded and suicidal thing to do. So you should be supportive of any girl that's out there, no matter how lightly she's speaking. You know, she's kind of softening the message, priming people, the bait, and then people can come in and dig deeper.
Promote the ideas like white Sharia. They don't want women to be involved, but they use the excuse that women aren't coming willingly to the movement, so we need to force them. And like, an Islamic ideology just seems to be a really good idea for how to do that. No. Look at Islamic countries. Like, I don't care if it's white people running it. It's still going to be shit.
Yeah, these are beta males. Chances are they don't have a woman. So they're a little too lonely, if you know what I mean. So a lot of frustration coming out.
Yeah, I've never encountered somebody with a wife saying those things.
Exactly. When you're busy with a
woman, you need to know.
Yeah, when you're busy with a woman and a family, you're not on YouTube commenting about how we need white Sharia to keep white women in order, because they're really secretly sluts who want to have sex with black guys, right? I mean, come on. Seriously.
Well, and it's the thing is, I mean, European women we do have kind of this strong independent spirit. We're not submissive. Like, and why would we want to be? Why would our men want us to be like that? Like, I see that as something really good about us that gives us an advantage over other people.
Yeah, we're not completely needy. We can actually help out and get things done. We're quite versatile as far as women. That's why white women are the first to fly a plane, to go in space. We've done countless firsts, you know, and we do thank our men who have built Western civilization, who have enabled that to happen.
Exactly. And we need to work together. The divisiveness is not helping to achieve the big picture goals.
Well, talk about your YouTube channel and let people know how they can find you.
Yes. So I have a YouTube channel. It's Philosophicat, like philosophical, but just change that last L to a T. And you should be able to Google me up. I'm also on Twitter under the same handle and on Facebook. And I think I've got about 10 videos up now. I try to do maybe one every couple of weeks.
That's great. Well, keep up the good work. It's great connecting with you. I think it's been a lot of fun, and I love where you're coming from and definitely relate to a lot of things you're saying. So it's been very fun.
Oh, thank you, Lana. Thanks for inviting me on.
On this subject, head to Omran and check out my in-studio interview with the classy, sophisticated Jared Taylor. Also check redice.tv regularly for public content, including radio, video interviews, TV segments, video commentaries, and news. If you like this show, please support it by becoming a Red Ice member. We have different options available. Most of what we do is free, and we have zero ads or sponsors. So head to redicemembers.com and click subscribe. You'll get access to special members content, including Weekend Warrior, our live TV show filmed every Saturday, sometimes Sundays. You can chat with members and call in during the show. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. And mark your calendars for two upcoming live streams, the French runoff election on May 7th and a surprise covert live feed on May 13th. That's it for now. Have a good night.